accession number 23439, reel 1.
John Adamson, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in Adelaide.
Which year was this?
1918.
I think you just told me you were born in the suburb of...
Well, it's one of the suburbs of Adelaide, in a suburb known as Hyde Park, south of the city.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Adelaide?
No. Penola, which is down near a largest town called Mount Gambier in the southern part of the state. Penola is a very, very old town in that part of South Australia. Much older town than Mount Gambier. But that's where I had my schooling. Went to high school in Narracourt, which is just about 30 miles north of that.
Now, we were discussing earlier off the record your middle name, which is Beveridge. Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, my great grandfather Adamson was largely brought up by his grandparents, who were Beveridges from Dunfermline. That's the linen weaving Beveridges. The Adamsons were wheelwrights. You know, I should think in a different social strata in those days. But the eldest son was largely brought up by his grandparents, Beveridge. And the other children came along, I suppose they were brought up by their parents, but they took the oldest son, which I gather was not an unusual thing in Scottish communities, for the grandparents to take the oldest son. And I think probably the education they saw that he got should have been very good stead in later years in South Australia, where he, in fact, became a very wealthy man.
And so you're related to Lord Beveridge?
That's right.
What relation is he?
Oh, my God. Well, I couldn't tell you exactly. But the Beveridge connection goes right back to my great-grandfather's grandparents. But the name Beveridge has stayed in the family all the years. And my great aunts, Adamson, were in touch with the Beveridge family. Oh, then one of my aunts, who became famous as an artist, she was always in touch with the Beveridges. But it's all died out now. Lord Beveridge, I did meet him once. By the time I came back to England to live, he was dead. So, you know, it's all died out.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
16, I suppose.
So that was about 34, 1934.
Yes, it must have been about then.
What did you go into when you left school?
Well, I was to go into photography, learn the craft from an aunt who didn't really do much about it. And I spent a couple of years trying to get any sort of work I could get. I suppose by that time... And then I went back to the farm with my father. And I suppose shortly after that we were caught up in the war.
Can you tell me about the farm that you had?
It was a mixed farm, about 4 miles out of Penola. The bulk of the income was from the sheep, wool and fat lambs. We had beef cattle, small herd, about, say, 28 to 30 breeding cows. And there was always a certain amount under wheat, anything from 80 to 120 acres under wheat. We were a little bit too far south for the good wheat country. They'd want to be further north. It was a little drier and a little hotter. But we used to produce quite a lot of wheat.
How big a farm was this?
606 acres, which today is all under grapes.
Had you not thought of growing grapes then?
No, no, no. We farmed it as you would expect a farmer to farm, with a mixed farm. I was really shanghaied into farming. At the end of the war, the Japanese war was finished. I was unmarried, commissioned, on points for discharge. I could have been in the army another 2 years. My father wrote to me, would I take an accelerated discharge to go back and work on the farm with him? And that's what got me back onto the farm. I was discharged, I suppose, in February, January or February, 46. And went back, bought a partnership with him. But inside 3 years he was dead. So there I was, shanghaied into it, absolutely. Never really wanting to be a farmer. And I simply carried it on. It's a duty more than anything.
Did you employ much labour on the farm?
No, only a bit of seasonal labour. I employed a gang for shearing. That included two shearers and a wool classer. And what we called a rouseabout.
What's that?
Well, he's just the handyman around the shed. That was the rouseabout. Other than that, I used to, as a rule, employ a young man to help me with the ploughing and seeding, which of course fell in right at the same time that we were lambing. And I needed somebody to help me at the farm at that time. Other than that, I didn't employ labour.
Did you hear, what was your reaction to the news that Neville Chamberlain had declared war on Germany?
Well, so far away we thought it was going to happen. It was pretty inevitable. But of course, like people over here, we weren't bang on to it. It was pretty distant. We knew we'd get involved in it. I can remember the day it happened quite clearly. We'd gone out for a picnic that day to the Wannon Falls, of all places. The little Wannon River was in flood. It was a very spectacular fall, not far from a place called Hamilton in Victoria. We'd gone over there for the day, and that's when it all happened.
Did you feel any sense of dismay?
Some, yes. I should think, basically, behind everything else, I know that war is wrong. It shouldn't be allowed to happen. It does happen. We have to accept it. But I know that it is wrong. I still feel that it's wrong. There should be a better way of handling it. Take note, Mrs. Thatcher.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not at first, no. And for a start, I joined the local militia. But from that, I went into the AIF. If you're going to be in it, you might as well be in it properly. And started off with horses. People won't believe this. Thank goodness we never had to fight with horses. And then the unit was made what they call a motor regiment. It was really motorised infantry. That lasted for a while. This is all in training in Australia. And they decided that we would be part of another armoured division, or they already had the 1st Armoured Division. 1st and 2nd, I suppose. And they decided to make an Australian Armoured Division. We were part of that. But we didn't get out of Australia, is that? But we were trained for desert warfare. But of course, things in the Middle East, as far as Australia was concerned, packed up and they had to be withdrawn from Malaya. But we never got sent to Malaya, although we were trained for jungle warfare. When we did get up into the tropical regions, we got our tanks bogged wherever we went. Not surprising.
Can I just go back to, you said, what is the AIF? What does it stand for?
Oh, Australian Imperial Forces. It was called that, they were called that right back in the First World War, as far as I know. I'm sure they were.
Where did you do the training?
In Australia, this was all in Australia, all our training. Victoria, New South Wales mainly.
Do you remember the names of the places?
Of the what?
Names of the places where you, in Victoria and so on?
In Victoria, it was done at a place called Pakapanyul. And from there, we went up to Singleton, which is northwest of Sydney. And then southern Queensland, within Cooey of Brisbane. And by that time, they decided they better send us overseas. We were put on draft once and taken off again. We were going to be landed at a place called Lae on the north coast of New Guinea. When the troops got in there, all they found were not a lot of Japanese, but one frightened Chinaman. And so we were taken off draft. And some months later, I can't remember dates now, we were put on draft again. We were sent up to Madang, which was further up the coast. We trained there. We carried on with our training there. The unit that I was in, 4th Australian Armoured Regiment. It was a kind of independent regiment that could be broken up into independent parts. Each part was complete in itself. While we were at Madang, one squadron, I think, must have been A squadron, was sent up to Itapi. And they did a bit of work up there, but not much encounter with the Japs, because by that time I think the Japs were getting all out of it. We just certainly didn't suffer any casualties up there, and as we weren't doing anything there at all, the US was pulling out of the islands and moving up north. And we were supposed to mop up in places, various islands in the Solomons. And that's when our actual regiment was sent across to Bougainville.
Before we moved to Bougainville, what was it like at Madang? What conditions were you living under?
Well, there was no fighting there.
But what conditions were you living under?
Well, one of the worst malarial places in the world. It's where one of the big rivers, I can't think which one it is now, finds its way out to the sea. And there's a huge area of marshy sort of country, ideal for malaria, as you might imagine. It was very, 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 very equatorial. It was hot. The temperature hardly varied from, we'll say, 94 at night to 97 in the daytime, something like that. This is Fahrenheit. It was very, very oppressive, 100% humidity all the time. Very, very enervating. However, we were camped on the edge of a big coral lagoon, lovely swimming. When people talk about shark-infested waters in the tropics, I always laugh at that. We never thought of sharks at all, never saw any anyway. But the lagoons were beautiful for swimming, because you could have done with them being a bit cold. The water was always warm. You didn't have to go down. If you dived down deeply, about 8 feet, the water was cool down there. I remember doing it was a recce patrol, you'd call it, back into the hills behind Madang on one occasion, from village to village, where the villages were still very, very native. A little bit of trade cloth to be seen, and that's about all. We walked through the jungle, dense, giant trees, and very, very dense, from village to village, a little narrow track, perhaps about 3 feet wide at the most, and the earth was all polished. Well, first time I saw it, I was at the head of the patrol, you see, saw this polished earth. Good heavens, what's done that? Then I realised, of course, bare feet. And this, in the Dang and New Guinea by and large, that was the only connection from one village to another. They were the highways. There was nothing else at all. You walked or you didn't go. And these little tracks were important to the natives. And if you were in a village, one of the little boys would usually take you on to a certain point where he'd point you on to the next village and then leave you. Well, he wouldn't go on into the next village. This happened several times.
Why would he not go into the next village?
I think probably that was regarded as the other village's territory. And they're territorially minded. You'd make your way down to the next village, usually a stream through the village, and you wouldn't just, this was just courtesy, you didn't just walk into the village, you waited there, and they would come down from the village, led by the second man in command of the village. His rank was Tool Tool. And they would talk to us and we would talk to them. They didn't know what we were saying, we didn't know what they were saying. But they knew we wanted to go up there and probably stop the night. Well, having Tool, having had his chat, he would bring down Lulu Eye, who was the head man. And Lulu Eye would then take us up into the village, and there was always a rest house in the village. I think probably the Papua New Guinea administration had organised that back before the war. There was a hut there that was known as the guest house, and we would be shown to the guest house, and then the women, the Marys as we called them, would come down with fruit, because they knew we always wanted fruit, and we'd trade our bully beef for fruit. They didn't like tin fish, they liked tin fish at all, but they liked our bully beef. So we used to get loads of pawpaws and bananas and other nameless things for our bully beef.
And you call the women what? What did you call the women?
The women were always called Marys. The men were boys, and the women were always known as Marys. I think that went back to the old civil administration days too. And a native regarded it as an honour to be called a boy. A Kanaka was a wild native from the interior. Kaneem just Kanaka man. But me boy, him Kanaka man, me boy. So it wasn't a derogatory term. And you had very little to do with the native women. Once the barter had finished for the fruit and the bully beef, they retired to whatever they did back in their huts. The villages were spotlessly clean. Just because it's earth everywhere, people seem to think that the villages were not clean. And there's a certain aroma attached to the villages. It's not foul. It's mostly due to smoke going up through the thatch. The villages are swept every day. There may be pigs running around, yes. But pigs basically are very clean animals. And they would see to it anything the pigs did was clean up, and the pigs would always do their job in the same place. So the villages, although they had you'd know a village before you got to it by the smell. It was not a stink, it was an aroma, but probably due to wood smoke going up through the thatch. Very interesting. The old men, I don't suppose they're really old in years, past working. You'd see them sitting outside their huts. There'd be a big banana leaf put down there, and the women would feed them, look after them. They'd spend their days just sitting there in the sun, while the younger men went out hunting as a rule. There wasn't much meat there, but they used to go out and get wild pig. And there were other things they got too. there was wild pig, but the pigs were introduced in the very, very early days, and of course pigs breed pretty freely. If you saw the natives going out to get a pig, that was men's work. When many boys and women around there, that was men's work. Go out with their spears, they didn't have any firearms, and get a pig. Big job.
Were relations between the Australian troops and the villagers always good?
I never knew it otherwise. I did know one occasion when some very misguided, this was when the war had finished, young men went up to a village not very far from where we were at Madame Rabaul and tried to negotiate for women. The men didn't like it. They came down and told us we got to patrol up there pretty smartly and straighten it all up. But that's the only incident of that sort that I ever heard of. It was unfortunate, but it can happen.
What did the villagers think to the Japanese?
I never really heard them express themselves on it. The Japanese didn't worry them much. I know that. The natives didn't like the Australian administration, ANGOW. Don't ask me what the letter stood for, it took me a long time to think of that. But they were those who organised the labour force, and the natives didn't like ANGOW at all. But I never heard of a native expressing himself on the Japanese situation. I don't think the Japanese worried them much at all.
Why do you think they disliked ANGOW?
Made them work. Simple as that. They paid them. Not that money was of much value to them, but they were paid and they were fed, but they didn't like being organised into work.
Were they obliged to do it?
Oh, they used to go out and force them into it by certain means. I don't know what means they used. There were persuasions that got them into it. They were quite well treated. They were well fed. Well, they always, physically, they always looked a lot better. There was an ANGOW camp on the other side of the lagoon where we were at Madang. They used to have a sing-sing every Saturday night. There was a sing-sing. It's all you could call it. They used to sing on about three or four different notes. It would start about 5 o'clock at night and would go on until well after dark, probably about 10 o'clock at night, interminably, without break. A good old pagan sing-sing. Well, that part of New Guinea was a Catholic area because they divided north coast of New Guinea, you've probably heard of this, into various areas for the missionaries. They might be Seventh-day Adventists, they might be Presbyterians, Anglican, Roman Catholic. Well, Madang was a Roman Catholic area. And all these natives would have their good old pagan sing-sing until the early hours of the morning, probably. And then, to our relief, they would stop. Then we'd see them next morning, all trekking off to Mass. Well, you know, it's a bit like an insurance, isn't it? It always amused us.
But carry on.
I don't know who administered their services. I think it must have been the padres from the various units round about. We had an Anglican padre. He may have gone up and done it for them. I don't know. But that's what happened.
Were there any Japanese air raids?
Japanese there?
Air raids?
Oh, no, it would have gone by then. Americans had chased them all out. anything like that, the nearest would have been Manila and up around that way. I never saw a Japanese aircraft in the air.
So you were telling me that from... How long were you at Medang for, do you think?
In Medang, we must have got there perhaps in September, October.
Which year?
Of 44. Yes, of 44. And I was there until, I suppose it must have been, or May 45, somewhere around about then. I know I took leave from there and I was flown down to Australia. Martin Mariner flying boat, first time I'd ever been in the air. And got back from Australia from leave, and we were more or less on the move to go to Bougainville.
Did you or any of your comrades get malaria whilst you were at Medang?
Not while we were there. I only knew one man in the unit who got malaria all the time we were up there, because we were on suppressive treatment. Stuff called Ativan. Turned us yellow, but it did suppress it. Never hear of it today. And he got it, and we discovered he'd been clever. He'd managed to avoid taking his suppressive tablets. You get these smart alecks. Chap that you wouldn't have suspected of it.
Why do you think he did it?
Oh, they imagine it's going to upset them in other ways. That's why they... They're always suspicious of any treatments that the army tells them to take. If it did anything to me, I'm not aware of it. I took it all the time. I went as yellow as any of them. It certainly suppressed the malaria. I never got an attack of malaria until after I was discharged. I'd been back in Australia quite some time before I got an attack.
Were there any other illnesses that the troops got whilst they were at Medang?
Oh, only the usual ones. The one that affects the bowel, you know.
Dysentery?
Dysentery. There was a bit of dysentery around. I got a touch of it once. Everything turned to water. They gave me a big dose, well, bung me into hospital, gave me a big dose of stuff they call sulfaguanidine. 14 tablets, followed by about a dozen, and followed by a whole lot more. By that time, if you stood up and shook yourself, you rattled. And I never got another touch of it. It cleaned that up completely. Apart from that, I think that's the only thing. Various skin diseases, which are probably unavoidable. I didn't get any, but then I was lucky, I suppose.
John Adamson, Real 2. Was the army feeding you and looking after you properly?
Oh, yes, we were very well fed. Even though a lot of it was dehydrated food, and dehydrated potato in those days was revolting. But the rest of the stuff was quite good. We got a certain amount of fresh meat up to us. Oh no, I couldn't criticise the food that we got. It was good.
What was your own job with the 4th Australian Armoured Regiment?
Well, I was a troop leader, lieutenant troop leader. Section... How many men? Eight. Lord, how many men in a section? Eight, I think. You forget things. Anyway, a troop comprised three tanks and their crews. And there was always a commissioned officer as troop leader.
Were the men easy to discipline?
Oh, yes. We never had disciplinary troubles. They were all volunteers anyway. It was a volunteer army.